jolly. A bit of ado. You don't have to buy it. It's entirely up to you. If you don't like the attitude, think the lingo ain't not proper, then don't join in on the no-brain opera. But we're your old cousins, nephews and nieces, weekend beaches. Pick up the pieces, pick up the pieces. Mothers of convention, leave the ad man's invention. Flat screen flukies, devout consumers, are the revenge of Montezumas. Leg it down, the retail centre, pin and enter, pin and enter. Bondage bound in fast food chains, wonders never cease. Two for the price of one in seven are clinically obese. Double, triple burger boys with inflated bulldog faces. Toilets as you wouldn't wish to find them in trains and other public places. But we're your old cousins, sons and daughters. Some what we say and do is pain in the hind quarters, pain in the hind quarters. You know our rights. We want it now at once and soon enough. We're never wrong, we'll shoot our bolt. It's always somebody else's fault. Always somebody else's fault. We're victims, we're victims. Leading up the garden path to the promised land. There's one in every town and city with identical high street brands. Follow your nose, sniff the saturated fat on the loathsome trail of the Kentucky Fried Rat. 'Cause we're your old cousins, fraternal relations, the sticky sensations of material aspirations, material aspirations, horses for courses of the market forces. Why not indulge in the shopping mall? You can stick that up your dos capital. You can stick that up your dos capital. Right up your dos capital, dos capital. One more observation, for I get on my bike. If you've got two the same, you'll find they're very much alike. Very much alike, 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 very much alike. Very much alike.
Hi, Rodney, and I must ask this. What's the weather like in England right now?
It's been incessant all April. The last 2 weeks, really, the last week particularly, there's flooding and everything. It's really a proper April. Mega showers.
Yeah, but didn't they just declare drought?
Absolutely, yes. It's the wettest drought since records were kept, yes.
The thing I always ask my British interviewees, of course, because of America, is because they think we all do it in lots, is what tea do you drink and how do you drink it?
Tea? Well, at the moment, I've just got myself a mug. It's my own blend of Co-op Basic Tea and Earl Grey.
Oh.
And I drink far too much of it.
Now, what percentage is the Earl Grey to the Co-op, though?
It's 50-50.
Nice and even.
Yeah. Makes a nice tea, I find, yeah.
Okay, now, and milk?
Yes, skim milk. You never hardly any milk content at all, but my age, I have to drink that.
Right.
I don't have anything too rich in cholesterol and things like that.
Three of the tracks on the Hair of the Dog do really relate to, we would say, getting old.
Well, I call it the art of mastering the art of living longer. Okay. Yes, they relate to life as it is now, yeah, which is you know, what else is there really? And I feel like it's as it is right now.
Yeah. Let's, to start then, let's go back to your childhood.
Oh, yes. Childhood. My childhood. What do you want to know about my childhood?
We are, you know, what we become. Mm-hmm. You started up in Lincolnshire.
I did.
How did you get down to the big smoke of London?
Oh, well, progressively. I started out in the wide open plains of the Fens. Mm. And then my father was a farmer. So I sort of grew up amongst rather idyllically, amongst flowers and crops and animals and things like that. And then all that changed when I was about 10. You know, the farming days were over. My grandfather retired and... Mm. My father didn't want to take it on. He wasn't under a great amount of responsibility.
Okay.
And so he moved into engineering, and we moved to Peterborough then.
Oh, okay.
Where that was the kind of the market town, which is also quite industrial as well. And I went to school there, King's School, for 6 years. Mm. Scholarship boy, my goodness.
All right.
And then I moved up to St Martin's, you know, which was the sort of quickest and earliest that they could sort of boot me out of my posh school. And, and I sort of became a bohemian around London around 1959.
You were seeing some of the, you were in the coffee shop skiffle days,
yes,
and things like that.
Well,
then.
Coffee shops were there, but it was it tended to be more licensed premises,
okay,
than I went for. Yes, I think the licensed premises of Soho, which is so much nicer than it is now. I mean, we used to drink in pubs with sawdust on the floor, wooden boards. I mean, it was another world, really. The art students in the 1950s.
Obviously, the music was going on, and you were hearing it in the pubs. Was that?
Well, there wasn't much music in pubs in those days.
Oh,
it tended to be in cellars. Cellars underneath the, you know, the business premises during the day of the West End, really. You know? Or, you know, there were sort of dedicated places like the Two Eyes, but that wasn't licensed. Didn't go in there much.
Right.
No, there were all manner of. Jazz and folk and things like that going on, small and large venues. Yeah, there was plenty going on, but not pubs as, you know, we would have... I don't know when the heyday of that was, really. Gigs in pubs, because then you've got these stupid laws that stop more than two people playing in so many small venues. I mean, that sort of... I can't remember when that came in. It sort of wasn't around when I was that young, but I can remember in the sort of middle of my life when I was a sort of jobbing musician. We were constantly plagued by music licenses and, you know, not being able to put small bands in smaller venues.
Where along the line did you pick up music? How did that call you? How were you inspired?
I did have some sort of formal lessons in music at school, but I didn't really like it. They weren't teaching you or what you wanted to hear. I couldn't have said what I wanted, you know, but I wanted it then and not the sort of classical sort of menu one was being fed. I sang as well for years. Well, I sang before my voice broke.
Hmm.
And then there were years in the wilderness, really, where I didn't sing at all. Well, I started, you know, along with the sort of rock and roll and skiffle boom that sort of hit the middle 50s. I wanted to be part of that, I think, and I just started to, you know, blow, bang and strum things until I sort of got up to London. And I was very lucky, really. I roomed with a guy who had a Saxon clarinet.
Oh.
And, let's have some of that. And, you know, I took to it like a duck to water, really. I started out life as a guitarist, really, and I was appalling, because I've got quite small hands, and I could never never make all these enormous, you know, chords over six strings. No one told me the easy way to do it in those days, you know, the Chuck Berry method and all those things. And I was struggling trying to play these enormous, bloody great chords, and it didn't come easy. Plus, I had a very bad guitar with steel strings.
Oh, dear.
You used to cut your hands to buggery, and I gave it up. The saxophone was much easier.
This morning, I swear I put it on. Did I leave it in the wardrobe? Is it hanging on the chair? Is it with my keys and bus pass? Christ, I've looked everywhere. Why do I do amnesia? Oh, Lord, I got the blues. Please help me find my feet.
Try looking in your shoes.
Oh,
silly old bugger, silly old bugger.
I used to be like Jumbo or Leslie Welch, remember him? The distant past shines brilliant, the recent somewhat dim. You'll often find me staring into space, confident that I've arrived, but why am I in this place? Good golly, Miss Molly, how did it come to this? Someday you'll all be old and stupid too, so don't you take the piss. Oi! Those senior moments, those senior moments, no senior moments to forget. Where's my memory gone? Oh, where's my memory gone? When I woke up this morning, I swear I put it on. Did I leave it in the wardrobe? Is it hanging on the chair? Is it with my keys and bus pass? Christ, I've looked everywhere. No, I've not got religion, and I've not been on the scotch. This is just my way of making sure I got my spectacles, testicles, wallet and watch. Oi! Those senior moments to forget.
Did you start just picking up gigs or sitting in with people? How did your professional life start?
Oh, well, once I got to art school and got my chops around the saxes and clarinets, I just played them. I could really, it was handy in those days. But I did kind of learn pretty quick. I wanted to do it. I think there was a strong urge there to sort of be out there making a stink, you know. And I just did that. I sat around, and then, you know, at college we obviously formed bands and things like that. sometimes you've got gigs and it just grew really into, you know, hanging around the places where the guys have.
And, of course, you know, that really brings us to that fateful day of the 25th of September, 1962, nearly 50 years ago.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I met Viv that day. I'd actually seen him before then. I was playing and the kind of things one did, a sort of all-night party at an old sort of abandoned church, which some of the guys at St. Martin's have got, especially calling it not the basement, the crypt, and a studio, a living space. And they threw this enormous party on Saturday night in Westbourne Park. And many of the trappings of the church were still in place there in the kind of nave bit. Mm. And there was a pulpit, and this rather fat, large red bearded, red-haired fellow with a frock coat and stiff collar sort of got up there and started ranting. That was Viv, and that was my first sight of him. And I thought, he's an interesting chap. And I sort of made my way over to have words with him just as the police sort of battered the door. They used to do things like that in those days. And sort of, you know, had us all out.
Oh, lovely.
Spoiled the bloody party, you know. So there he was, and he vanished into the night one way and I went the other. And then 2 months later, Tom Parkinson, who was the chap I shared the flat with in West Dulwich, sort of came home with the same red bearded fella. And so, who had just come up from Southend and had nowhere to stay. So we got talking, and of course it seems that everybody knows about now, playing the dreadful word game that brought up the band name. You know, he stayed the night, and he stayed the next 3 or 4 months till we all got kicked out of the flat. And of course we'd formed the band by then. And that was the first sort of knock-ins for about 3 months. Viv and I were the only ones that kind of went on from that, from the very humble beginnings. We just kept going and formed a new band until all the rogues that we all know about sort of appeared and, you know, were incorporated into it.
That was pre-Beatle. I mean, the Beatles hadn't hit.
I mean, it really changed the world, I think. It, you know, without admitting it too much at the time, it changed my world because you suddenly saw what was possible. You know, there were things happening with the Beatles. Things began to happen that really just hadn't happened before. All that Beatlemania and all that. I mean, it's extraordinary, really. I mean, you know, for young people of that age, whatever your sort of persuasion was, and I must admit, I didn't think much of them at first. All these girls wetting their knickers and things like this, you know. I'd like some of that.
You did a lot of slogging, you know, in the trenches for quite a few years, really.
What are we talking about? The Beatles were really big in 64, and, you know, 1962 into 1963. But it all went wrong then. I mean, there were only Viv and I left, and we started again, so to speak. And as you say, that's when the other fellas all burned up one by one over the next 2 years or so. And then it got a bit bigger then, because it was better. Usually, you know, we were working around in art colleges and things most of the time.
You and Viv founded it. You know, what vision did you see? Did you say, oh, we're going to do this, or just see what happens?
It was very much see what happened and really living off your wits, so to speak. Whatever sort of came out, you let it go. It was really like that. And I mean, I was into making loud, fast noises. And he was, you know, doing his plum voice singing, really, and his kind of... his surrealistic mind was beginning to find its feet, you know. His utterances were becoming, you know, weirder every day, really. His visions, his ability to see the same things that other people were looking at in an entirely parallel world, really. It all began to slowly emerge. He didn't write anything for probably 2 or 3 years. And then it all began to spew out, you know. There was no ambition. Well, no, that's not true. There was a kind of ambition, but there was no plan.
Yeah.
No plan at all. And I think it really, the actual foundation, the strength of the band, lay in the characters of the people who eventually, became it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very much about all our ego trips, really. A platform to act them out and a certain amount of cooperation to let someone else have centre stage for part of the time. It's been tough in the Bonzo Dog Band. It sorted itself out in the end into the sort of 6 strongest personalities who were not going to be shoved out by the others.
Okay.
And a lot of people fell by the wayside who were probably, a bit better mannered.
But I suppose that's, Anarchy One, perhaps, which is...
Yeah. In the end, there were 5 left who weren't going to let the others push them out. And an addition of Benny Cowan on bass. Because it had got quite musical by that time and it needed a proper bass player.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, it got musical.
It got musical. It wasn't. It was genuine music. I mean, people have always described musical anarchy and that. I think it genuinely was for a while. I'm not going to say anything different, really, because it always, especially in the early days, and what we do now relies on the, well, are they that bloody good that they can play so badly when they want to? Or are they just totally awful? And it's an intriguing question. I think most people know the answer now, and it's probably changed there for 40 years. But it was always that was, when we burst into the astonished world of straight show business, are these guys really good musicians who can convince us that they can play so badly? One paradox. We lived off that for years.
The mystique, yeah.
Yeah, no one was going to say,
Well, I didn't feel I had a judgment because you'd blended, comedy and music together and political, everything, commentary. That was such a synergy you'd put together.
Yeah, we just had a lot to say, big mouths.
I wrote a song about a man who rode a motorbike. He drove too fast as he sped through the night. It had a sticky ending, smashed into a tree. And my song got banned by the BBC. I wrote about a girl who lost her only friend when he married someone else. She knew it was the end. So she jumped off Beachy Head and landed in the sea. And my song got banned by the BBC. The more my song was banned, the better news for me. Everybody knows there's a story to be told. So they all bought my record and turned it into gold. Cause it's banned by the beat.
Banned by the beat. Banned by the BBC.
I wrote about a girl and boy who fell in love. It had a happy ending with rainbows up above. They played it on the radio morning, night and noon, but nobody bought it, though it had a pretty tune. The more the song was banned, the better news for me. Everybody knows there's a story to be told. Turn it into gold, banned by the beat.
about a singer who flew off in a plane, and after he was gone, he was never seen again. The plane he was flying in crashed, oh dearie me, and my song got banned by the BBC. Hooray!
I noticed somebody I hadn't heard of much of is the guy who spotted you. Can you tell me about Reg Tracy?
Oh, Christ. Reg Tracy. Well, it's unfortunate. It is the late Reg Tracy now. But, what can you say about Reg Tracy? I mean, basically, he was a nice bloke. There's no question about that. But he was too much of a nice bloke to be involved with us. you know, I mean, nice people didn't get very far in the Barnsley Dog Band. We were a kind of pack, you know, a hunting pack. We turned on people very quickly if they weren't exactly art school and like us. Now, Reg had an insight into show business and getting us going in the direction of doing this professionally for a while. He basically thought pretty much in an orthodox way, and we thought in a very surreal and unorthodox way, and that ran into how we should be managed and where we should be playing and what we should be doing. Once we'd got over the initial sort of of actually busting in or being the door being open for us.
Right.
Once we got over the amazement of that, he soon became rather critical and destructive. And he didn't last long, to be honest.
Mm.
Well, he certainly got us going. I think he got the EMI thing as well. I can't be actually sure on that now after all these years, whether it was him that... Well, it may have been Jerry Brod. I can't remember. No, I think it must have been Reg, actually. He got us going up north, you know, into cabaret, you know, again, you know, this was extraordinary for a bunch of sort of surrealistic art students to go, you know, play for ordinary sort of working northeasterners. We really thought we'd be slaughtered.
Mm.
You know, we went out there with some apprehension, actually. And these guys just got it straight away, loved us. You know, there was no stopping us there. There we were, you know, working, doing 14 shows a week in these bloody northern clubs.
Oh.
And being adored in the northeast. It was extraordinary. It was a great time. It was boom time on Tyneside and Teesside then. And it wasn't about the other side of the Pennine either, on the northwest, you know, Manchester and Warrington and places like that. We learnt an awful lot because we genuinely did like, you know, what was then going on the clubs was the sort of last sort of vestiges of variety and music for. So they were all stand-up comedians and jugglers and girl dancers and all this stuff. It was all very theatrical and sort of funny.
Interesting. So in an odd way, it just all fitted in by its own serendipity or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
You go from, like, northern clubs, you're appearing at the UFO on the psychedelic club in London,
yes.
You know.
Yes, it kind of happened. it went down all right. I mean, But, you know, you sort of think, well, the people there were so sort of out of their heads anyway. Anything, you know, sort of different would probably go down all right. Or no, I don't know, you know, sometimes you... Well, I know, it's a subjective thing. Sometimes I would feel, Christ, I'm in another world to these people, you know. I don't know whether they're seeing what I'm doing or you know, what's going on in their heads about anything I need to be doing, you know. I felt about that kind of thing. You know, I'm not a great enthusiast of sort of recreational drugs or whatever.
Okay.
Not even alcohol now, you know.
Okay.
3 glasses of wine and I'm anybody's now.
Yeah. What type of wine, you know, this is wine country here. What type of wine do you like?
Well, I'm very unadventurous. My favourite wine is light Italian wine, like Al Portello or something like that, or whatever I find in France.
Okay.
You know. No, I'm a little conservative about the New World wines.
Okay.
They tend to be bloody 14% and things like this. My tolerance has gone down anyway.
They're making beers at 9.5% now as well here.
God, I mean, that burn your throat just goes down, you know.
In that mid-60s of London and England, I mean, the whole world was watching and... and then you get... I first saw you on Do Not Adjust Your Set. I think you're all wearing Frogman's outfits with bubbles blowing and singing a song. It was mind-blowing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's jumping a few years. When did we start doing that? Although it all went so quick. Now, the interesting thing that you made me think, you know, by saying that, I seem to have been born at a sort of time where one's own sort of milestone maturation sort of matched parallel movement society where so many more things suddenly became available and new developments, just as you were maturing yourself and evolving. It was almost as if I was in step with you know, the world becoming a better, more interesting place, because there were definitely changes going on out there.
Yeah.
I don't know whether everyone thinks that, but, you know, to be in your early 20s when all that was happening was more than you could have wished for, say, 6 years earlier.
You were mixing a lot of things up, so you're getting into, you know, TV and some different type of gigs at that time.
Yes.
How was that?
Yes.
How did that work? I mean, working with all those other creative people, say, on Do Not Adjust Your Set, and, I mean, that must have been... it looked really fun for us watching.
It was. It was fun for us doing it. I think it was fun for them as well, being with us. It was a good old sort of, you know, people got on well, we sparked off each other. A lot of it, of course, went on and probably, well, it isn't going on now because most of the sort of Do Not Adjust Your Set became Monty Python. And they were Oxbridge, and there was also just as strong art school sort of culture as well, which was taking over a lot of, you know, what, like alternative show business before it all gets to the point where they become establishment. I mean, Neil was sort of very much trying to be a Python, you know, he was sort of always involved with them, you know, doing writing and stuff. But Biff wasn't. Biff ploughed his own furrow. He was a different sort of person entirely from Neil. He would dearly love to have been part of mainstream entertainment, and yet if he was, he knew he would have sold out and he wouldn't have been doing what he wanted to do. And his personality by then, and his drinking, were such that no one was going to risk him in that direction anyway.
Obviously, being a long-time friend of his, you know, how was that, you know, working around that, you know, the drinking problem he had? And
well, it was probably, you know, matured at the time that the band split up, and that may have been part of the small part of why the band finished when it did. I think a frustration, really, that, well, I know certainly for me, to have gone much further would have been to sell out. You know, because we had, as you say, we'd become absorbed in all this. It was great fun. and most of it was on our terms. But for me, I mean, I think it was a definite for his selling out, and I think there was a bit. Although he longed for recognition and inclusion. He was such that he would never get it if he was true to his own, you know, heart, really.
Yeah, had to be on his own terms, yeah.
Yeah, and greatly admired by all professionals around him, but never a big earner, never a big performer on the popular stage.
Sir Rawlinson seemed to spend more and more time with his Alsatian owl. His friends told him, "You should get up more, Percy, or wind up looking like a dog, ha-ha." He was later arrested near a lamppost. At his trial some months later, he surprised everyone by mistaking a policeman for a postman and tearing his trousers off with his bare teeth. In his defence, he told the court, "It's hard to tell the difference when they take their hats off." Pench was playing the trombone when she heard a knock on the door. "I wonder who that is at 11 o'clock in the morning," she thought. But cautiously opening the door instead of the turbaned ruffian she expected, she found a very nice young man. "Mrs. Pench, you've won the car contest. Would you like a Triumph Spitfire or 3,000 in cash?" she smiled. Mrs. Pench took the money. "What will you do with it all?" "Not that it's any of my business," he giggled. "I think I'll become an alcoholic," said Betty. Geranium behind each ear and his face painted with gay cabalistic symbols, 6'8", 17 stone police sergeant Jeff Bull looked jolly convincing as he sweated and grunted through a vigorous twist routine at the Fraga Go-Go beer keller. His hot serge trousers flapped wildly over his enormous plastic sandals as he jumped and jumped and gyrated towards a long-haired man.
Excuse me, man, I reason to believe you can turn me on.
He leered suggestively. As if by magic, dozens of truncheons appeared and mercilessly thrashed him. Poor Jeff, what a turnout for the books. Much as he hated arguments or any kind of unpleasantness, Ron Scher thought things had gone too far when, returning from a weekend in Clacton, he found that his neighbour had trimmed the enormous hedge dividing their gardens into the shape of a human leg. Enraged and envious beyond belief, Ron seized his garden shears and clipped his white poodle Leo into a coffee table. "That'll fix it," thought Ron, but he was wrong. The following Wednesday, his neighbour had his bushy waist-length hair cut and permed into a model of the Queen Elizabeth and went sailing. Everywhere he went, people said, "Hooray!" Sometimes you just can't win.
You tasted, I mean, you had hit records. Wow, Paul McCartney, you know, helped you, you know, Urban Space Band, got into the charts. Of course, you're on Magical Mystery Tour. I mean, the only band in the world ever to have been in a Beatles film. I mean, that's like godlike by itself.
Well, yeah, we did these things, but, you know, I just look at it like, well, that was what was happening in my life at that time. It was just like a trajectory that one was on, and I think a lot of people would sort of say that, well, this is just happening, this is life, this is what's happening to me today, 4 or 5 years' time, or what will happen in my case, you know, I was back in teaching or whatever, you know, you've done these things and carry on with the next sort of bit of your life, you know.
Right, interesting, yeah. As we were saying earlier about living in the now, you know, you only know what it is now.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, you're living in the now, so enjoy it. Get on with it. The past is in the present. The past is in the present. You know, you carry that experience into what you're doing.
You know, on the more sleazier side of things, how was, you know, management and contracts? I mean, were things done by handshakes, or did you have to, like, you know, sign in blood? You know, how was that side handled?
Well, I mean, we were very, very casual about it, really. I mean, we signed things without really understanding them. I think three management sort of, or whatever you call them, teams or moguls, whatever they were. We got ripped off by the record companies, as everybody did. I mean, the last two CDs that the, probably the one before that, the Four Bombs, though, one, that wasn't a record company. You didn't have to get a contract. You know, people were willing to put up money on funny projects, or as it is now, we're completely a home industry now. Mm-hmm. You know, we do it all ourselves. And the Bum Notes, which is coming out in this month, actually, we've done it all ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, there's no record company. You know, any bugger with a laptop can pull it. It's the record for this front room now. I mean, ultimately, an artist pays for it, you know, having a good time and all that. But, you know, the tandoori chicken comes home to roost eventually. You know? Sorry, that's a quote from one of my songs. The Cairo two-step.
You were fairly quiet in the Bonzos.
I was.
With your music make, writing.
Why keep a dog and bark yourself? You know? Yeah. No, I was quite happy just to play the music, really. I didn't. I was very inarticulate until I sort of, when the band was over, I started reading psychology and stuff like that, and sociology, and became a therapist. And so I went through a certain amount of analysis myself, and I just began to talk and want to say things more, rather than just make noises on a horn and express it that way. And as I get older, there's something definitely to say about life now, whereas I didn't have that urge at all when I was younger. I mean, I was very much part of group contributions and talks and joint things, but I never, you know, unlike sort of Vim and Neil, you know, they just couldn't stop their ideas from coming out in words. I was a different person in those days.
More the George of the band, yeah.
The George, yes. Yes, poor George. Another one, that's the...
Back when you were trying to play the guitar, maybe if you'd picked up the ukulele, your small hands would have been perfect for it now with the...
Well, I did in later life take sort of a great comfort from that, plonking about on a ukulele. I'm very happy playing, you know, saxophone and woodwind, really. That's where I've been for the last 45 years, forever now. Bought a new clarinet, a new bass clarinet on Thursday, and I'm still sleeping. I've owned several and got rid of them over the years, and then when we were recording Bum Notes, you know, there's a couple of factors. Some bass clarinet. I borrowed one. That was it. Had to go off and buy one. So the band will be dominated by an inappropriate bass clarinet.
Lovely. It's about time, well, you know. The Bonzos broke up in about 1970, and...
March the 14th.
Oh, okay. Wow.
I'm good at dates.
But you'd already sort of embarked on another career as a social worker, is that correct?
I started off doing social work, and then I became a strategic therapist. It occupied the next 21 years, I think. We'd still be doing it if it wasn't for that wretched woman who also appears and always referred to it a lot of my songs nowadays. You know, I jacked it in, actually. If I couldn't run my department without all these bloody middle managers and accountants that were inflicted on us, and I just had enough of it. And but it had a happy ending, you know, packed it in, and the next day I was on tour with this. It was a smooth transition, you know, from being the cool professional back to being on the road with Stanshaw, who at that point was trying to be a reformed character and in fact did manage, you know, for him a long time being sober, but he couldn't unfortunately keep it up forever. I was back then and I had to earn a living as a musician, so I found myself often wearing DJs and playing bass in restaurants and things like that.
Yeah.
But it was great fun. It was a great mix of music, actually. I played all sorts of stuff, and 7 or 8 years I was the full-time trove. Then I had a bloody heart attack on stage in Hemel Hempstead.
Of all places, yeah.
Of all places, playing Night Boat to Cairo. The last tune, and I just put the sax down and said to the baritone player, "You'll have to take over." I'll take it. And it, mate, I feel awful. And, you know, I was rushed off to Hempstead General Hospital and spent the next fortnight there recovering from a bloody heart attack.
Wow.
Yeah, it'd be a great way to go, wouldn't it?
Yeah, the Tommy Cooper way, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. You know, you're up there doing it and then, no, you know, plonk, all gone, finished.
Hello, and how did you find yourself this morning?
Well, I just rolled back the sheets and there I was.
When Mr. Slater's parrot says hello, and Keezer likes to get one on the go, we hope to hear him swell, we love to hear him squeak, we like to see him biting fingers in his horny beak. Sometimes he wants to whistle through his nose while picking up a peanut with his toes. If Johnny Morris had him on his show, you'd hear the purist's favorite say
hello. 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 Hello.
But now, through all this, do you still keep parrots?
No.
Ah.
No. No, I stopped keeping parrots in about 1974 or 5, I think. They just got too bloody noisy. You know, I mean, I had kids as well by that time, so I couldn't cope with all the racket.
So, now, kids, how many kids do you have? Are they following in your footsteps?
Well, they both play, but not professionally or...
Here we are, then all of a sudden the bonzos start stirring. You suddenly find yourself in the maelstrom of bonzohood again.
Yeah.
I mean, what an amazing rebirth that has happened.
Who could have predicted it? The spirits of what was there. that much really. Well, you really, okay, this, we do use the spirits of the early Bond days, whatever the spirit of the Bond days forever, really. You know, I've never stopped focusing on what I think is absurd and trying to find a platform to say that, really. So this is great that there is a platform there. Obviously, it's not such a big one, it's not such a, you know, it's not so widely seen because young people have their own thing. Although we do get a few, you know, actually gratifyingly increasing numbers of younger people, not really young people, because there's no getting through to them if you're over 25, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but there's a lot of people in their sort of 30s and 40s that usually through their parents' collection or some sort of, maybe the sort of one, you know, the great worldwide net is getting things to people that otherwise wouldn't have done. But there's a lot of people there who just want to get in on the sort of retro and nostalgia and tribute out of that. You know, the tribute for you.
You're floating your boat with the three Bonzos. You've got, you did the Hair of the Dog last year. Or was it 2010 now, I think? And you had about four tracks on that.
Yes.
And we've got the new one coming out, Bum Notes, imminently.
Yes. I just kept writing, and Dave turned a few things out, so we started putting them down and suddenly realised, you know, we've got five or six tracks apiece, you know, that we could put on. So we said to the others, come on, bloody right, I think it's time we put another CD together, you know, why not? Because, well, I mean, my view is that there are some songs you can write and they sound and are good on record and difficult to perform on stage, or you haven't found out a way of making them meaningful on stage, they're just songs. So there's an awful lot of that. And there's the formula that we have, you know, obviously we do have, I should think, about 50% or something like that, you know, exactly. But, you know, stuff that people want to hear from the old days that we can do with the line that we've got now. And then the rest of it is stuff we've done in between then or what we're doing now. I have to keep sort of writing songs and you can't get them all into the band because we're not that sort of a band. If we all performed what we wrote, there'd be no nostalgia left. And probably that would undermine us commercially. And, you know, what people will want to come, they'll only take a certain percentage of what you are now.
Right.
And what you used to be. It's a slow old process, you know, to bring them right up to maybe what you're doing now. So there's always that quota to keep balanced. But the way that we work is, I mean, I don't think it's actually any different than we ever did. Viv and Neil wrote what they wanted to write. I write what I want to write, Dave writes what he wants to write, and then Roger can be stirred, you know, he writes what he wants to write, or records, you know, the bits and pieces that he feels like. So, you know, there's this sudden rush of urgency where someone will sort of kick-start the process and say, look, we've got enough stuff here with a few more from you, or a few ideas, and so we put them together. But the thing about three Bonzos is, there are five of us.
Of course.
And we all live at different points of the compass, with a great geographical sort of distance. You know, Sam down in Devon, Roger's in Kingston, I'm sort of off the edge of North London, and Dave and Andy are in Brighton. Now, we don't get together, we don't hang like we did in the old days. We weren't all living in each other's sort of, you know, suitcase. There's a lot of distance, so
yeah.
We have to do a certain amount of things to ourselves. And we don't book studios, obviously, we can't afford it. And we just get together, those of us that can, around Dave's house, where he's got enough equipment to, you know, produce a decent sound and working conditions. And we do our own individual things, and if other people can get along and put themselves on if you want them to, then they do. Otherwise, you know, I mean, some of my tracks, apart from the things I can't play, are all me. That's the only way I'm going to get it done.
Okay.
it's the same for everybody.
Interesting.
You know, because of the great geographical distance, but we overcome that by just getting on with what we can and people drop in and help each other when they can.
Yeah.
But sometimes you find you're doing something, that you've done it all yourself, apart from a keyboard track or something that Dave will put in to, you know, deliver bass.
Mm.
And obviously, we don't have a bass player, which is a pain in the arse. It's not so much of a difficulty live on stage, but it's overcomable anyway.
Mm.
It'd be nice to have a bass player, you know, playing all the bass instruments possible.
Right.
That's the old philosophy, you know, someone who can double on a brass bass, a string bass, an electric bass, and any other bass sound that anybody else he wants to bring along, you know, a massive one-man bass department.
I love
it. We haven't got that. It would be lovely if we had the...
Scorching rubber through yarn of dogs, acting crazy like a box of frogs. Spaced out in his tradesman's togs, scattering young mothers and their sprawl. Anointed with plaster and paint, patron saint of consideration he certainly ain't. Plus he's white van man. He'd even flatten his old neck. He's worse than Mr. Toad on testosterone overload, cos he's white van man. Now, it hasn't turned out to be all bad for the sons of Jack the Lad. Realisation at an early age. Yes, you can make a decent wage as a bricky or a chippy or a Texas plumber if you can't be a drummer in a rock and roll band. And he couldn't. No sense of timing, you see. I know one like that because he's white van man. He'll upset you if he can. He'll pollute your urban space with open window drum and bass because he's white van man. Look out, he's behind you. How would you like him to do it right up your rear bumper, missus? Because he's white van man.
White van man.
He'll upset you if he can. He'll pollute your urban space with open window drum and bass. Because he's white van man.
White van man.
And he's a rope that manners maketh man. And that goes out the window in a van. Overtaking, undertaking, straight to the front of the queue. And if you don't like it, you know what you can jolly well do. Cos he's white van man.
White van man.
He'll do an outrage if he can.
If he can.
He's done more that he didn't order than the grand from grocer's daughter. Cos he's white van man.
White van man.
Look up, he's behind you. That's all right, it's only me. Come to give you a quote to clean out the moat. Yes, I can do the wisteria all right. Might as well have a look at your soffits while I'm up there. 1,500 quid cash. All right, David. The ladder's on the roof. They're all the living proof. That's white van man. White van man. White van man. White van man.
Now, you've got quite a schedule this year of gigs. How's it going?
Well, we would just come off a sort of month doing nothing. it's like that now. Is that a good schedule? I mean, you know, the world has changed. You know, when we really got going, you know, we were doing like 9-day weeks.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that seems to not just us. That I'm doing that amount of work. From where I kind of stand, that's what I seem to, you know, people are always talking about being on tour. Well, that was just everyday work for us.
Hmm.
You know, away from home, it meant you were away from home most of the time, working, you know, all over the country. Now, it seems that, you know, it's much more for the thing to, you know, put, I don't know, anything from 10 to 30 sort of dates together and go off and do that. And they call it a tour. That was just a week's work for us. You know. But that's how it seems to work, and people don't seem to work as much. Probably they spend more time in studios or recording.
Yeah.
But we've always been a performance band. We still are, really. That's where we're most together. That's where we, where the sparks fly off each other. That's where we fire each other up in live performance. You know, and there'll never be enough of that for me. You know, I just love it.
Yeah.
I love... I always use that terrible word, touring. Yeah. On the road, let's put it that way. You know, go off to the hotel and have a few glasses of wine and a nap for 2 or 3 hours. And you know, that's what being in a band, being in a show, the business is about, as far as I'm concerned. It's not just on stage. It's we don't travel much together either, because we're all coming from different directions, you know, occasionally. But it's so far... then we'll hire a van to take the gear up and we'll go by train.
Mm.
But I tend to go by train most of the time, unless it's just a short one. Well, nowadays, of course, there are parts of the country you can't get to by rail anymore.
Oh, oh well.
You know, so I have to make alternative areas. I hate driving. So the only snag is I can't take as much equipment and instruments around as I want to do now. And I mean, you know, adding the bass clarinet, as you know, another mod from the back. You know.
Strap it to the top.
I've got to buy a bigger rucksack to get all the bloody bits and pieces in.
I bet it was amazing how much you could get in a Bedford van back in the day.
Yes. I mean, what I wouldn't give now, how much the show would improve, you know, if we had a, you know, a communal vehicle and a couple of roadies.
Yeah.
How much life would be better, how much we'd enjoy it, I think. I mean, I don't understand it. People like Roger and Dave, they'll drive 200 or 300 miles home after a bloody gig.
Wow.
You know, I mean, why, for Christ's sake? You know, get me in a hotel with a bar with a glass of wine. You know, that's all I want after a show. I mean, I've actually got the physical strength or will to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
To drive. It's just a boring thing to do.
Yeah, after all that.
You could be, you know, chewing the breeze, you know, and sort of giving them to no one else.
The new CD is coming out imminently, isn't it? You're going to do a big show to launch it?
A big show to launch it. Well, we're putting the banner up, but,
yeah.
You know, like most, well, no, not like most, because, I mean, you see, this is the difference. Bands now sort of go in these steps, don't they? Okay, we've got a new album, we'll do it. But we're not a band.
Right.
We're not a band that sort of, you know, is there just for music. Well, we'll be doing a few of it, but there are some we actually can't do. Because there's so much multi-tracking and things, or they're not suitable for live performance, but hopefully they make jolly entertaining listening.
Mm.
But I mean, we'll do as much as we can. We are marking the occasion by saying this is a CD launch. It'll be a good evening, and you know, we're not in a position to sort of be able to, you know, put out 10 new bloody tracks. I mean, that would require a rehearsal.
Right.
And I think one of the slogans you probably know is you never knowingly over-rehearse.
Oh, right.
It's not all just a slogan.
As long as the love and passion is there, I mean, it's so great for the fans and the new people you're going to pick up. I know I've been so excited and enjoyed... what you've done since you've all come back together. It's, you can't stop now.
No, you can't stop. You've got to keep on doing it in whatever way you can, really, I think.
Oh, dear. Well, I really appreciate the time and depth we've had to chat about your life and career, Rodney. It's really fun.
It's all right. I enjoy talking. I enjoy having a platform. I'm not a great self-publicist, but I do enjoy a good matter. I do enjoy a good discussion or seminar or whatever. return to academic life, if you like. I do enjoy exploring things and talking about them,
Well, and that's why we love you, because that, you supply that wild and crazy streak that we all would love to do more of.
Keep the mischief going, the mischief. And if possible, even now, I enjoy getting up authorities' nose. Even though I have, been into the elevated heights of authority myself sometimes, I don't think it does you any harm to have some sniping coming from underneath. Keeps you thinking, keeps you looking at every angle.
In my book.
All you can do as an artist is draw attention to things, and I think if you do it in a humorous way, you've probably drawn some attention that wouldn't have been there, fleeting it. People are looking at situations that you're sat to arising or humorising, And you get a bloody good laugh out of it as well.
Two for the price
of... Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I think that's what the enduring love people have, for the bonzos. A lot of people recognise that.
Yeah, they say so, which, really is good. They want to subtract off of Lucy, and none of us are clever enough to actually be able to make this playable on the radio. we couldn't send them a CD, obviously, it's too late. But apparently there's something you can do with. Oh, I'm absolutely hopeless when it comes to technology, but even Roger couldn't manage that. I can't do it for you, I'm sorry. It's beyond me doing that. Quite a lot of things. One always thinks of Roger as a sort of mechanical and electrical wizard who can produce anything.
Yeah.
But even he is being left behind by some of the stuff now and admits it. And I think, what, you?
Yeah.
he's a bloody, sort of blag you up to be an absolute scientific genius.
Oh dear, we are all lost, yeah.
No, he's just as sort of lost as I am on some of these
sheds and outboard motors, roller skates and pop-up toasters. I find tires exciting. Don't you? I've told you before, I don't.
keep doing it. It's been great to speak to you, Rodney.
Okay, and, I better let you go. It must be 10 o'clock in California now. Oh, God.
Yeah, 10:30. The sun is up and the sky is blue.
Well, you better get out there and make a big splash or something. God, you know, making a big splash. David Hockney is real big at the moment.
Oh, he's back.
Can't get into the Royal Academy. And it is a wonderful exhibition. Yeah,
I see he made that, you know, I saw Peter Blake did that cover of Sergeant Pepper, but updated.
Yes. Well, what are these both people? You know, I mean, Peter Blake was on my tutors, for Christ's sake.
Really?
And a neighbour in Chiswick. Yeah, he's a big part in my early life, really. And of course, he became very sick with Ian Dury. But the other thing, I'll let you go. I'll just tell you this story, because it's one of my favourites in David Hockney.
Yeah.
And goes back to the very beginnings, origins of the band, when we used to play in the Junior Common Room at the Royal Academy. And, you know, Hockney was an incumbent in those days.
Yeah.
And this was the time when people literally came to physical blows about the merits of traditional and modern jazz. And there was one of these bloody discussions going in there, and people were getting really heated up. And there was Hockney sitting there, and he suddenly went, "Well, I like Jimmy Shand." It was an awful Scottish accordionist. You didn't know. And that was it. It just, you know, that was completely it. Fucking knocked the arse out of this great row that was going on. Wonderful. I'll do this again. Yes, get on with my life.
I've
got a raised bed I was making there in the garden. I better go and finish it in the gloom.
Oh, indeed, indeed. But, have a great evening, and I really appreciate it. And thanks so much, Rodney.
Okay. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I like my cheese hard. I like my cheese cold. I like my cheese hot because I like my cheese on toast. Special Christmas treats.
Nazareth.